Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Before we get into today's show, I want to let you know that I am off for the next few days. My good friend Lori Boyer will be taking the reins while I'm gone. She is a farm broadcaster who's been doing this for many years. She's also the host of the Ag Queen podcast and a former president of the National Association of Farm Broadcasters. So you are in very, very good hands. So we're going to start our show today with news. Many states in the West still have high topsoil moisture shortages. Stephanie Ho reports.
There still are many states in the western half of the country that are showing high shortages of topsoil moisture.
Unfortunately, Montana has managed to avoid most of the precipitation recently, still standing again this week at 96% short to very short, leading the nation.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey points to other areas in the country with severe dry conditions.
And we still see numbers greater than 50% in a handful of other states from the plains westward. That list includes Washington State, Oregon, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas. And so that's kind of your driest pockets.
Meanwhile, he notes recent precipitation has led to improvements in topsoil moisture conditions in California.
It is notable that in California, where the big storm hit the northern end of the state, another big decrease this week in topsoil moisture, very short to short, just 15%, down from 40% a week ago.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
When the USDA announced $700 million in aid for biofuel producers, the industry called it a light at the end of the tunnel. Chad Smith has details.
Congress allocated those resources in December of 2020. Tom Hitchcock is the CEO of Redfield Energy in South Dakota. He says the biofuel industry was hit hard by COVID-19 and is still waiting for the promised relief.
The whole program remains in regulatory limbo, which has created lots of anxiety and uncertainty among ethanol plants and producers. In mid-June of this year, the USDA said that the application window would be open in 60 days, yet it's been well over 4 months now since that was announced, and still no application, no clue on how the aid's going to be allocated to biofuel producers, no definitive date on when the funds will be distributed, nothing. So we're kind of in the dark. On several occasions during the past few months, U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack said the administration would act soon. The can seems to keep being kicked down the road for some reason. The biofuel industry certainly can't afford to keep waiting.
The assistance is especially important because the industry was excluded during the first round of USDA's pandemic assistance. The biofuel industry is a vital part of the supply chain.
U.S. grain producers depend on a healthy industry to be able to market their feedstocks to ethanol plants. U.S. livestock producers rely heavily on distillers' grain feed supplies. A vibrant, profitable U.S. agricultural industry is good for our country and the world. During the early part of the pandemic last year, over half the industry was offline. Some closed their doors for good. Certainly some scary times at that point. At Redfield Energy, we were forced to slow our production down to about 60 to 70% of normal. All of this, however, cost a lot of money, but we felt determined to stay open, to be a market for corn farmers and supplier of feed products for livestock producers in our area.
Like other ethanol producers, Redfield Energy faced a lot of additional costs and uncertainty due to the COVID-19 precautions they put in place to keep people safe. Biofuel producers are still waiting for the promised help.
We keep hearing that the administration is working on it, but it's hard not to be disappointed. This is not the only source of uncertainty from Washington, D.C. We're also waiting on vital decisions on the renewable fuel standard from the EPA, which is yet to set quotas for 2021 and 2022. A wrong turn at either agency could be devastating, but kicking the can down the road is not an option.
The industry really needed that assistance some time ago.
Frankly, we needed this funding a year ago, and every day we wait, the harder it gets to make plans for our business. President Biden says he wants to lower fuel costs, protect the climate, and support the rural recovery. Biofuel producers are ready to make this happen, but we need a signal from the White House that this administration is standing behind those promises. We need Secretary Vilsack to step in and push this COVID relief out the door.
Again, Tom Hitchcock is the CEO of Redfield Energy in South Dakota. Chad Smith reporting.
Widespread supply chain issues are pushing prices higher and prompting questions on availability of crop inputs. Michael Clement shares more on what farmers and ranchers are experiencing on the ground.
Supply chain issues impacting fertilizer, seed, crop protection products, and even machinery parts have farmers facing another challenge in growing a crop. Marietta Hauser, a Southwest Kansas farmer and Farm Bureau Women's Leadership Committee Midwest representative, says the price and availability of products to raise a crop are the biggest challenges right now.
It's pretty tough right now with the cost of chemicals that we need to put on the crops, the cost of the seed, everything's going up, and it's short. We don't know for sure if we can get it. So it's pretty hard to plan for the future when you don't know what you're able to have available to you. And it affects all areas of our life. It isn't just the farmer. It's all of our rural communities and the big cities as well.
Hauser says farmers need a reliable supply chain.
We need to know that we are going to be able to source the things that we need in order to farm. Farming is a business where we're on a deadline to get the crops in. We're on a deadline to get the crops out. We've got Mother Nature throwing weather events at us. We need the reliability of knowing the inputs that we need to do business are there.
Despite the supply chain issues, farmers are still getting the job done.
We are out there farming. We're getting that product out there. It may be a challenge for the consumers to get it. They're paying more. We get the 14 cents out of every food dollar, and that 14 cents is still what we're getting. My input costs are higher. 14 cents makes it a little hard to farm on and make a profit.
Michael Clements, Washington.
An annual look at world agricultural productivity indicates an increased rate from the previous year, but is it enough to keep up with the growing global food demand? Rod Main looks into it.
It's an annual look at global agricultural productivity, produced in part by Virginia Tech University and culled from USDA Economic Research Service data. And the most recent report announced at the 2021 World Food Prize Week indicates
agricultural productivity growth is not increasing as quickly as previously thought.
According to Ann Steensland of Virginia Tech, world ag productivity is currently growing at a rate of almost 1.4% annually. By comparison, estimates have that rate needing to increase over 1.7% every year from now to the year 2050 to meet continued global demand for food. Steensland says there are two reasons why the current production rate is behind the projected sustainable rate.
The first is a change in the methodology for calculating productivity. FAO has published new data on agricultural capital, which includes farm buildings, livestock herds, and mechanization. This data gives us a more accurate view of how we are using these inputs compared to how much we are producing.
She adds, new data on climate impacts appears to indicate global ag production growth
has slowed by 21% since 1961. In drier regions of Africa and Latin America, it is as high as 34%.
The ERS data on international ag productivity notes total factor productivity, which measures ag output produced by a combined set of factors, is up compared to inputs. Steensland explains what this means for world food and farm production.
Since the 1980s, total factor productivity growth has been the major contributor to agricultural output. The use of inputs per hectare has declined significantly. Land expansion has remained relatively stable.
Yet Steensland says around the world there are troubling trends within TFP, such as all new ag growth in sub-Saharan Africa originating from opening of land versus increased sustainable practices. She believes through recommendations such as
investing in public agricultural R&D and extension, embracing science-based and information technologies, improving infrastructure for transportation, communications, and finance, cultivating partnerships for agricultural development, food security, and economic growth, expanding and improving regional and global trade, and reducing post-harvest loss and food waste.
Farmers of all scales throughout the world can increase individual and global ag productivity. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Turkeys are fetching some of the highest wholesale prices in years as supplies shrink. Gary Crawford has more.
In the U.S. turkey sector,
for about the past 4 years, we've seen production falling, being reflected in tighter supplies of turkey and lower stocks.
Much lower. USDA livestock analyst Chael Shagham says a few years ago, turkey producers were seeing low prices as their production was growing faster than demand. So the industry began to gradually reduce output. The result now, stocks in cold storage end of September this year, 17% below last year. And of course, that's leading to much higher wholesale prices.
Wholesale prices for frozen hen turkeys, which is what we track here at USDA, peaked in mid-September at about $1.44 a pound, which would be the highest level on record.
At least since 2005, when USDA started tracking that price. Now, prices did decline a little bit last month, down to an average $1.33 a pound, but that's still about 16 cents more than October a year ago. Shagham says this could mean consumers will likely pay more for their Thanksgiving turkey this year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's our news for today. Taylor Chalstrom is up next. We will be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Kat Jarvis Sheen, UCCE Orchard Systems Advisor, about dormancy in tree nut orchards and what trees do during the winter. Welcome back, Kat.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Good to have you here. Kat, my first question for you here, ideal conditions are needed during dormancy for tree nuts in order for a strong start in spring. You know, what are some of those necessary conditions for dormancy and how do needs maybe vary among some of the different tree crops out there?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, we're talking about winter chill when we talk about dormancy. And so the trees needing to experience a certain amount of cold over winter to be essentially convinced the winter has passed and that it's safe for their delicate little flowers and new leaves to come out. And it's not just, you know, one warm day in the middle of January. And we talk about different crops and different varieties within those crops having different chilling requirements. Historically, we've talked about it as chill hours, so any hour under 45 degrees. As time has passed and you know temperature recording equipment and computing and all that stuff has advanced, we've come up with more sophisticated ways of counting. Trees are actually very good at high level math, apparently, but that's the basics of it. But you know what we've been finding more recently that it's not just a straight ahead accumulation of cold being experienced, but also swings in temperature can really affect whether the tree is counting or keeps counting. So we've had, you know, if we have very dramatic warm days and then cold nights, those warm days can cancel out a lot of the chill credit that you would have otherwise gotten from the night before. So it's not just a matter of getting a certain number of days, but also how high the highs are, not just how low the lows are during winter.
And you do a lot of work in the Sacramento Valley. I'm curious when you talk about those fluctuations, you know, what are you guys seeing up there during the winter in terms of fluctuations? Is it pretty large or not that much at all, that type of thing?
You know, I mean, it's always a little warmer down where you guys are. Like in the San Joaquin, I'd say roughly 5 degrees. But when we have warm days, you guys are having warm days too. You know, like And so in the winters of 2013-2014 and 2014-2015, we had were historically quite warm. And we would see things like middle of January, many days in a row in the 70s and 80s for like long chunks of the day. That sort of thing can really set back your chill accumulation counter.
The trees need, you know, these adequate winter chill hours to come out blooming in the spring. I'm curious though, what needs to go wrong during dormancy for these tree crops to not come out synchronized and be ready for bloom there?
Yeah, so what usually ends up going wrong is, well, either we don't get enough cold or we get too much heat is the basics of it. So again, if we have those warm conditions in, we get most of our chill accumulation in December, January. So that's really when warm conditions have the most impact, because that's when we usually get the most cold. So if our minimum temperatures, our overnight temperatures are warmer than usual, if our daytime temperatures are a lot hotter than average, and the other thing is, you know, we're seeing less fog than we had in the 70s and 80s. And that means that the buds and the wood are out there kind of cooking in the sunshine in a way that they weren't at the same air temperature when there was fog around. So those are the three things that can go wrong, I'd say, when you're trying to get towards meeting your chill requirement to break dormancy.
Is there a definitive reason why we're seeing less fog these days as opposed to, you know, 30, 40 years ago?
There are a number of reasons. I mean, one, actually, fog is encouraged by particulate matter. And so as we've cleaned up our air quality in the Central Valley, that has contributed to less fog. We have a lot more paved surfaces. And so there's a lot more urban heat island effect. And that can keep the overnight temperatures higher, and then climate change. So we've seen an increase in about 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 30 years, mostly in the last 30 years in the Central Valley. So that has also contributed to things being warmer and just not having the right conditions for fog in the winter.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, we're back talking with Kat Jarvis-Sheen, UCCE Orchard Systems Advisor, about dormancy in tree nut orchards and what trees do during the winter. Kat, I'm curious, you know, some of these winter freeze events, some of these fluctuations have had adverse effects on some walnut growers in the state. You know, how do severe winter freeze events like those that the walnut growers have experienced in recent years affect growth after dormancy, you know, growth in the spring?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because we talk about different cold events that happen during winter or winter-ish timing, and they can have very different, you know, cold temperatures can have very different influences depending on when they hit an orchard. So what we've had for the last 3 years running, especially on the east side and really walloping walnut orchards, as you say, is a sudden cold in early to mid November, So temperatures being pretty mild, pretty warm, and then a sudden drop in temperatures that is below freezing and sustained for many, many hours, and sometimes a couple of nights in a row, depending on which year it was. And so that is, you know, that's a freeze event as opposed to winter chill, which is like between freezing and 50 degrees Fahrenheit is when you get good quality chill. So those freeze events can essentially burst the membranes of the cells, and then everything leaks out and you can't get it back together. And that messes up the wood in a way that is hard to recover from. And a lot of walnut growers can identify with that, then having to, once they see how things bud out in the spring and maybe even waiting ideally into May and June to see what can finally make it all the way through and what is definitely just pooped out, then cutting out that dead wood. And so freeze events, different from winter chill, even though they're both about cold. In some ways it is related to dormancy though, because once those trees go to dormancy, then they are much better at tolerating those very cold events. So the problem has been in the recent past, in the last couple of years, is not just that there's been a big drop in temperature very suddenly, but that it's been pretty warm up until then. So if we had had milder and milder and cooler conditions leading up to those events, those trees would have been well on the way to dormancy already and probably been able to manage those cold temperatures. And I'm jumping ahead, but that actually relates back to what I think you're going to ask about also is carbohydrates, because the trees use, you know, they have carbohydrates that are either in the form of sugars or starch, and they actually use that sugar as an antifreeze within the cells so that the cells can tolerate even colder conditions. So that's one of the reasons that as trees go into winter, they start turning some of the starches, which is like their stored fat essentially, into sugar. But if the trees haven't gotten cooler and cooler conditions to signal like you need to start turning some of that more back into sugar, then they won't have that antifreeze in place to be able to sustain or, you know, live well through those temperatures.
Yeah, and I do want to get into those carbohydrates in a second, but I did have one question. As far as I know, before these last few consecutive years of these winter freeze events, they were fairly sporadic. You know, growers didn't have to expect it every year. What's really changed in that regard? Why are we just seeing these consecutive events? Is that maybe a result of climate change, that type of thing? You know, what's really going on there?
To be honest, we don't have a slam dunk answer for that. There's a combination of things. We have a lot of, you know, a fair amount of newer acreage, people who are really pushing that acreage. And so we could be managing our water and our nitrogen better at the end of the growing season with these walnuts so that they shut down sooner to start going into dormancy and settling down. But, you know, there's plenty of growers who have mature orchards, who've been doing this for decades, if not generations, who were walloped by these cold temperatures. And so, certainly there's something more than just like management not going right. And I think we're still parsing this out, but I think a lot of it has to do with those warmer conditions leading up to that big drop. So it's not that we don't usually get a big drop like that at some point in November. It's just that things are otherwise warmer and the trees aren't preparing for those drops in temperature in the way that they used to. So yeah, which is related to increased temperatures probably that we're seeing from climate change. Well, we know our temperatures are increasing in the fall, so it would be related back to that.
Okay, definitely. Thanks for that. And now I definitely do want to get into those carbohydrates. You talked about how they kind of act as an antifreeze for the tree. And there's the Z Lab at UC Davis is currently researching some of these dormancy-related activities in orchards. Mm-hmm. And one of those avenues of study is non-structural carbohydrates, or NSCs. I'm curious, how do trees use NSCs during dormancy? If you could expand on what you were talking about before, and why is it really important that growers keep track of them?
So non-structural carbohydrates, that's a big mouthful. It's basically, you know, carbohydrates are also the cell walls, other parts of the tree. So we mean the carbohydrates that are floating around that the tree can utilize without having to, you know, eat itself alive. And so that can be in the form of starches or sugars. And the tree can move carbohydrates back and forth from those two pools. But basically it's going through the growing season, sending a lot of carbohydrates into using, you know, doing things like defense, respiration, taking up nutrients, you know, the day-to-day stuff that trees need to do, plus sending some of those carbohydrates into growing. But at the same time, it's churning out extra carbohydrates and putting them away in the larder, like in the, you know, in the cupboard to stock up for winter. And then during winter, you know, the tree, we don't see leaves out there. They look like they're not doing much, but they are still alive, respiring, defending themselves against cold conditions, et cetera. So they are still using energy. So, and they need to draw down on those reserves that they stored away in the cupboard during winter. So, so these non-structural carbohydrates are stored energy that the tree uses during winter, and they are, the sugar part of them are more like active in keeping things to tolerate, tolerant of cold conditions in a sort of antifreeze way. And it's important to track, because if you draw down on those reserves too much over winter, then you get into spring and you're pretty hungry, and you don't, as a tree, you know, you don't have a lot of oomph to then, you know, get your flowers out there and start growing your fruit or your nuts or whatever. And so that storage, we're learning more and more about how that storage and how much you have stored once you get to spring can be fairly determinant of yield. Because, you know, that bloom time is a really critical time. I mean, obviously everybody knows this, this is why we try to get it right, but is a real determinant time of yield. And we get a lot of, you know, drop at bloom, and then later June drop in May. The tree has its own balancing act inside of it to sense, I mean, I don't think I have enough reserves to carry all of the nuts that I set on this tree, so I'm gonna drop some of them. I can't make it through. And so, yeah, so if you don't have enough carbohydrates going into the spring, going into that bloom, then you can baby those trees for the rest of the year. But if in that couple of days they were like, I can't make it with all of these, then they're gonna drop a lot of them and you just won't have as high yields.
How do growers going into that, how do they ensure that they do have enough carbohydrates? Is it, can the grower do anything to change that, or is it really just up to the trees at that point?
So this is the problem with starting to talk about cutting edge research before it's all like cooked and everything is figured out. You know, we've been looking into the Z Lab has been looking into this for the last 5 or 6 years, which is a pretty short time span in terms of developing a science around something. So I know that's frustrating as a grower to be like, well, you're telling me about this thing, so how do I use it? But we're still figuring out, they've done a good job in those past 5 years of figuring out what the baseline is. But now they need to look back in the cahoots with farm advisors at, okay, if I manipulate this knob, can that increase my carbohydrates over winter? If I, you know, pull on this lever, what does that do? So we're not quite there yet.
You kind of also talked about some of the research involving that you can kind of look at these NSC levels going into spring and tell how, what the yield might be, you know, how does that work?
So that's still at the researcher level. There's not really like a great lab that you can send. Well, I should say, you can send your samples to the Zwinyeki lab because they definitely need grower collaborators on this. But you would need to send them a couple of times during the growing season, not just at bloom. There's not like a paid lab service right now that you can send in a spur in late January and know what your almond yields are going to be that year.
If growers were to want to do that, how would they kind of go about doing that? How would they get in contact with the Z Lab?
Yeah, I think the best way is probably just to Google UC Davis Carbohydrate Observatory, and that'll take you to a website that has a lot more information on the research, and there's a contact us tab somewhere in there.
Okay, perfect. Well, Kat, I have time for one last question here. I'm curious, do you have any other tips for tree nut growers as we're approaching the dormant season here? You know, are there any management tools they can use to ensure trees come out of dormancy ready for spring? I know we were just talking about how there's not a lot we know at this time what they can do for carbohydrates and whatnot, but maybe anything else that they can do to ensure trees get through the dormant season.
Yeah, there's a lot of research going on in this right now. The Walnut Board is funding me to look at things that you can apply late in the winter if the trees don't get enough winter chill to wake them up like they normally would wake up. We call them dormancy breaking chemicals, but none of those are labeled for use in walnuts right now. And there's nothing officially labeled for that purpose in pistachios right now either. So that research, we're working fast and hard to get that out, but we don't have any tools in the toolbox just yet.
Well, Kat, thank you for coming on today and talking about some of these issues surrounding dormancy. There's certainly a lot that I learned about it. I hope some others took some stuff away from it too. We appreciate you coming on and talking about it today.
Yeah. Thanks, Taylor. Happy to do it.
This is Taylor with My Ag Life signing off.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. Desal, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. Desal will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's Desal flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With Desal, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. AgroMayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgroMayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgroMayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Welcome back. What kind of weather patterns will this coming winter bring? Gary Crawford gets us the latest forecast from experts on this edition of Agriculture USA.
Walking in a winter wonderland.
Throughout modern times, songwriters and others have tried to romanticize winter. Cold, wet, dark winter. Enough, I say.
I love the winter. Weather.
He does, I don't. Nonetheless, it is my duty to relay on to you what the weather experts are forecasting for this coming winter. So I will do so, reluctantly, on this pre-winter edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. Ah, yes, a sound effect supposedly recorded somewhere in the equatorial waters of the Central and Eastern Pacific Ocean, where it just turns out, by coincidence, that the nature of this coming winter in the U.S. is likely being shaped as we speak. For a second year in a row, these waters here are cooler than normal, and that is what is called La Niña, which
tends to have a fairly profound impact on North American weather patterns during the cold season.
Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey will come back to you in a minute, Brad. First, let's go to John Gottschalk with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center. That's a handful of words. His group has already made its forecasts for this coming winter, and he says, in general, most times, usually, a La Niña pattern causes predictable winter weather in the U.S., and so his group is now predicting
above average precipitation and colder than average temperatures for some areas of the northern tier of the U.S., and below average precipitation and above average temperatures across the south.
That very basically is the forecast for the period December on through February. Now let's go back to the Agriculture Department's Brad Rippey. First, for areas that, Brad, have been suffering drought over the last year or longer, what would this NOAA forecast hold?
There is promise for some additional drought relief in places like the upper Midwest and the Northern Plains, where we have just started to recover from that historic summer drought that greatly affected agricultural production for crops like spring wheat, durum wheat, and barley. We also expect to see drought relief in the Northwest, extending eastward across the Northern Rockies. And that should help out states like Washington and Oregon, Idaho and Montana that have been hit hard by drought for several months.
So if you live in those areas, and if you like a colder and wetter than normal winter, what's wrong with you, you will probably like what Brad said there. Now, on the other side of this forecast, first, it's not good news for farmers or anybody else in Southern California.
Southern California has been dry for more than 2 years. That's an area that we could see drought further intensify, leading to more water supply issues, especially if that dryness extends into key watershed areas of the southwestern United States.
And now then, moving east and south from there, forecasters are looking for warmer and drier than normal conditions into the southern Great Plains. And on that score,
we've already started to see some pockets of drought developing across the southern half of the Great Plains, particularly in Oklahoma and Texas. There sometimes is, during La Niña, a tendency for that dryness to expand northward from the southern Great Plains, occasionally reaching as far north as, say, Kansas and Nebraska. So for winter wheat folks, something to watch across the central and southern Great Plains.
Yes. Now come the disclaimers in all of this. Number one, La Niña patterns don't always produce the weather happenings that are normally associated with La Niña, but they do often enough for forecasters to at least base their predictions on those happenings. And disclaimer number two, Brad says just because the forecast calls for, as an example, a warmer and drier than normal winter, that does not mean it's going to be that way every day, all the time.
And so day-to-day weather can vary dramatically from that. We got a good taste of that last winter. We had an overarching warm winter for most of the country, but we had episodic cold outbreaks, including the historic February outbreak that devastated the Great Plains all the way southward into Texas with record-setting cold. So you have to understand, day-to-day weather can vary greatly from this three-month mean forecast.
And sometimes these early winter forecasts just turn out wrong. So at the end of February, we'll see how well the forecasters in good old La Niña did in forecasting the winter. Ooh, I don't like winter. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm already very cold. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Burr.
That's our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.